Namaum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Shimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminite Namine. Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasyacha Hare Krishna,
What's that? Oh, you can give me Bhagavad Gita, yes. Anybody have any questions? Maybe I should start with that first. Okay. What did I read last night? 12th chapter. 16?
16.
You said you were beginning the Visbaharupa. You were beginning the discussions on devotional service. Is that what you said?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, you were. You said that, Victoria.
Yes.
Uh-huh. 12th chapter. Yes?
No, we are on Bhagavad Gita, we are on 10th chapter right now. But on the Bhakti Vriksha, yes, it's
12th. 12th chapter. Uh-huh. Okay. Including me. I think I silenced mine before I came in here.
It's a webinar.
I did. I silenced it before. Okay, I'm going to read from the continuing from the Bhagavad Gita 12th chapter. I'm going to read from verse 18 and 19. Two verses together. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Namo
Samat Shatrao cha Mitre cha Tata Mana Pamanayo Shitoshna Sukha Dukeshu Samasanga Vivarjita Tulya Nindas Tutirs Mani Santushto Yinakena Chit Aniketa Stira Matir Bhakti Man Me Priyo Nara. Translation. One who is equal to friends and enemies. Who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge, and who is engaged in devotional service. Such a person is very dear to me. Report. A devotee is always free from all bad association. Sometimes one is praised, sometimes one is defamed. That is the nature of human society. But a devotee is always transcendental to artificial fame and infamy, distress or happiness. He is very patient. He does not speak of anything but the topics about Krishna. Therefore, he is called silent. Silent does not mean that one should not speak. Silent means that one should not speak nonsense. One should speak only of essentials. And the most essential speech for the devotee is to speak for the sake of the Supreme Lord. A devotee is happy in all conditions. Sometimes he may get very palatable foodstuffs, sometimes not. But he is satisfied. Nor does he care for any residential facility. We sometimes live underneath a tree. We sometimes live in a very palatial building. He is attracted to neither. He is called fixed because he is fixed in his determination and knowledge. We may find some repetition in the descriptions of the qualifications of a devotee, but this is just to emphasize the fact that a devotee must acquire all these qualifications. Without good qualifications, one cannot be a pure devotee. Harav abhaktasya kato mahadguna. One who is not a devotee has no good qualification. One who wants to be recognized as a devotee should develop the good qualifications. Of course, he does not extraneously endeavor to acquire these qualifications, but engagement in Krishna consciousness and devotional service automatically helps him develop them. Om Ajnana Timarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chaksho Onlinitam Dhyanatas Vaishi Gadave Namaha Mukam Kuroti Vachalam Pangum Langayate Garim Yakripatamaham Pande Shri Gurundinatananam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Shimate Bhaktivedanta Swaman Iti Namane Namaste Saraswate Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shanyavadi Pastya Chade Sutarane Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaiti Gadadhar Shivasari Gauravaktivinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I have a sense of who I'm speaking to here, but who am I speaking to there? This,
they can hear you too.
I know, but who am I? To whom am I speaking?
To us, of course.
No, because Kamur. Streaming.
He's a private. Yeah, that's okay. It's just everybody can see.
No, who?
There is Katya, our.
Oh, so it sounded like it.
And there is Ananta Priya.
Oh, I see. Just a few people. Okay,
I there just. There's two translations, one somewhere and one is on the Facebook, so we don't know.
Ah, okay. All right. Just thought I should check. We're continuing in the section of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is describing the characteristics of his pure devotees, those who are very dear to him. When Krishna, in many places in Bhagavad Gita, he emphasizes what makes a person dear to him. In the 18th chapter, he says, for one who explains the secret about others, for him, devotional service is guaranteed, and in the end, he comes back to me. There's no servant in this world who's more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. Krishna is a person, and the whole Bhagavad Gita is meant to help us to understand what is our relationship with him. In the beginning, Hare Krishna. This is not so easy to understand. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada, when presenting the Krishna consciousness philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, he also introduced chanting as the primary method for understanding our relationship with the Supreme. It is said that chanting, Cheto Dapanam Ajana Bhava Mahada Bhagni Nirvapanam, chanting cleanses the heart. It cleans the heart from external designations that we've been identifying for many, many births. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna is instructing Arjuna, he is instructing Arjuna to help him to become free from a bodily conception, which is sometimes not very easy to become free from. A bodily conception of life is based upon the false understanding, the false notion that the spirit soul, that I am the body, and the purpose of my life is to satisfy the needs of my body. I remember one time I was having a conversation with my stepfather, and I was trying to give him a very, very elementary explanation about how the soul is different from the body. The soul is eternal, the body is temporary. And I was giving the example that we tend to identify with the body of the self due to conditioning for many, many lifetimes. But as Krishna explains in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, that the soul is eternal and the body is temporary. And he tells Arjuna that you are lamenting for what is not worthy of grief, because those who are wise lament neither for the living nor for the dead. And then he says, Dehi no spin yata dehe komaram jovanam jara. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at the time of death. Dhiras tatra namuyati, that one who's dhira, one who knows his spiritual nature, he's not bewildered by that change. And he gives the example, Krishna gives the example, that a person takes off the old clothes and puts on a new set of clothes, similarly, the soul sheds the old body and accepts another body. And the whole Bhagavad Gita helps us to understand how the body, how the soul transmigrates from one body to the next, to the next, to the next. In the course of one's life, one accumulates reactions to one's life, one tries to fulfill so many desires in the course of one's life, and as Krishna says, as the air carries different aromas from one place to the next, the living entity carries his different conceptions of life from one body to the next. And then he goes on to explain how the soul is given another body in his next life because he's always accompanied by his eternal companion, which is the super soul, which is the manifestation of the Supreme Lord within the heart called Paramatma. And the super soul in the heart, his function as the super soul is to witness our desires and to give sanction for everything that we want to do in this world. We cannot do it unless the Supreme Lord gives sanction and says, okay, you can do. I was explaining these very elementary things to my stepfather about the soul. And I was giving him the example that Srila Prabhupada was using, that even in our own terminology, when we speak about the body, we always refer to it as my hand, my head, my foot. And I even asked him to do an experiment with me. And I said to him, can you please point to your head? And he pointed to his head. And then I said, can you please point to your knee? He was cooperative, very cooperative this time, to a certain point. It might sound surprised that he even cooperated that far. He was trying to understand. So I said, can you please point to your knee? And he pointed to his knee. I said, very good. Please point to your foot. He pointed to his foot. And please point to your chest. He pointed to his chest. And then I said, now please point to yourself. And he went like this. And I said to him, no, you just said that's your chest. Why are you pointing there? I said, I asked you to point to yourself, but you're repeatedly now pointing to your chest. You're already designated. Why are you pointing there? I tried to make him understand that it's because it's the soul is situated within the heart of every living being. And by nature, when we point to the chest, we're actually pointing to the self, situated within the body. But he didn't accept that. I said, point to yourself. I said, I said, no, that's your chest, point to yourself. So he took one hand and he put it on his foot, and he took the other hand and he put it on his head. As far as he could get. I said, no, you already said that's your foot and that's your head. Where are you? And at that point, he walked out of the room. couldn't take it any farther. It's not easy. We're conditioned. We're conditioned. We're especially conditioned because the tendency is that we live our life fulfilling the demands and the needs of the body. And the more we invest in the body, the more we begin to identify with the body. Srila Prabhupada, he once gave the example of the difference between the soul and the super soul. And he describes how the soul is, he's kshetragya, he's the knower of his own field, of his body. But Krishna is the knower of all fields. He knows all bodies. And Krishna doesn't identify with the body in the same way as the soul identifies with his one body. He knows what's going on in his own body, but he doesn't know what's going on in others' bodies. But Krishna knows what's going on in everybody. Because he's, as the super soul, he's manifested in the heart of every living being, and he's acting, as we said, as the witness and as the permitter. So Prabhupada gave the example. He said, just like a person, when he invests so much in a car, for instance, if somebody has a new car, especially if the payments aren't made on the car yet, we're always very careful and attentive to make sure that the car is properly maintained, the oil is changed, we wash it, and we do make many payments. We're investing a lot of our energy in the car. So the person who's driving in the car, he may pick up a passenger in the car, and the passenger is accompanying him, somebody he just picked up on the road. And as he drives, all of a sudden, he gets hit by somebody else. And when he gets hit, immediately he thinks, you hit me. You hit me, why? Because he identifies with the car, because he invests so much in the car. So much of his energy, his wealth, his attention, his concerns, the needs for its maintenance. He feels pain, although he wasn't, the car was hit, because he identifies with the car. But the passenger, he gets out and walks away because he's not invested anything in the car. He does. The more you invest, the more you identify. So the more we invest in the body, the more we identify with the body. And if we take into consideration of the, as the preliminary teachings of Bhagavad Gita instructs us, that we've been investing in bodies for many, many births. And Krishna said to Arjuna, many, many births both you and I have had. I can remember all of them, but you cannot. He was explaining to Arjuna how Arjuna has accepted many different bodies, accepted many births. But when Krishna appears, Krishna doesn't take an ordinary birth. He appears ajopisanaviyatma-bhutanamishuropisan. He appears in his original transcendental form. This is a topic, a broad topic in of itself. But the reason why I'm bringing up these points is here in these verses of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is explaining to Arjuna, what is it that makes somebody dear to me? Who is dear to me? Somebody, and he's describing, this verse describes, one who is equal to friends and enemies, who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge, and who's engaged in devotional service, such a person is very dear to me. As I read this, I can't help but think of another analogy. I like to use analogies because they're so helpful to us to understand something that's may not be so easy to grasp. But I use this analogy a lot, but it's about the dualities, because Krishna is speaking about one who's not affected by heat and cold, not affected by happiness and distress, not affected by fame and infamy, honor and dishonor. Duality is the means to be influenced by good and bad in this world. When something is good, we're happy. When something is bad, we're in distress. And all of us go through the dualities of this world. But Krishna says, one who transcends these dualities is very dear to me. Transcends the dualities, but how to transcend the dualities? Then this is the analogy I wanted to use about transcending dualities. Everybody understanding this so far? Am I getting?
Yes.
This is what you're talking about in your bhakti riksha?
Yes.
It is.
Yeah.
So, okay. Do you talk about dualities?
Yes, we spoke about dualities.
What did you say about dualities?
Well, it's just that we are here. It's like an ocean, and a wave goes in the middle. And when you are on a dry land, or you can be either on the dry land, or you can be in the ocean. But Krishna is above all that. He is not influenced by all that duality of our world. Because we have here bad and good, and sometimes we go into the close to Rajaguna. I'm not talking about Sattvaguna, because it's the aim, it's the target for us to get into Sattvaguna, but it's way too far. We can go just exposed to that company, and then all of a sudden, you know, we somehow get influenced by the Sattvaguna. And that's why this duality of this world.
We get influenced by the modes of nature.
Yes, yes.
But Krishna doesn't get influenced
by
it. So Krishna is transcendental to duality. Yeah, just like the sun is above the clouds.
Yes.
The sun is not covered by the clouds, but our vision of the sun is covered.
Yes,
that's Krishna says, Yachaiva Sattvaka Rajas, Rajasas Tamasas Chaye. He says, I am above the modes of material nature. So yes. So Krishna is transcendental, but what about us? We're in duality.
We are not.
Huh?
We're transcendental yet.
We're not transcendental yet. Yes?
So
how do
our
we
wishes.
How do we become transcendental? How do we transcend duality? I know you don't talk about sattva guna.
Yeah.
But first we should know what is duality, and then we should know how to transcend it.
Chanting.
Chanting?
Yes.
Yes. Definitely, that's a way to transcend duality.
And just to try to understand that we are in this position and we need to pull ourselves from this position.
Yeah, Krishna says actually in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, for one who conquers his mind, super soul is reached and he attains tranquility. For such a man, heat and cold, happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, they're all the same. In other words, one who conquers the mind, he transcends the dualities of this world.
But that's the hard part.
We could discuss that. It's the hard part. But first we have to know what is duality and why we suffer by duality. Just like Arjuna, he was in duality, right? Arjuna was thinking, if I fight, there's going to be so much suffering. I'm going to suffer. And I'm going to cause pain to others.
Right?
To relatives, yeah. Tough. He was in duality. He was bewildered. All right. That's one example of duality. Right. Another example of duality. We can think of so many. Give me examples of dualities. I'll let you give them. Who can give me other examples of dualities that we face every day? Yes.
Oh, you do something good to me, you're my friend. If you offend me, you're my enemy.
Yes, that's very good. And Krishna says that right here, doesn't he say? No. I think Prabhupada spoke about it in the purport, about friends and enemies. Another example of duality.
You want to sleep in the morning, but you have to go to work?
Yeah. I don't want to go, but I have to go. Right? Yeah. Many people can relate to that.
Maybe green and red light?
Green and red light?
Simple.
Yes, it can be seen that way. Green go, red stop. Excuse me?
The kids?
Kids. You have to take care of them, but you want other things you want to do.
Yeah.
Right? Right.
That's another example of duality. We're being torn. Internally, we're in conflict. Like, just like, when I heard your example of having to get up for the work in the morning, I always give this example also. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna explains, there's no work that affects me, nor do I aspire for the fruits of my work. And one who knows this truth about me will never become entangled in the reactions of his work. And in this verse, Krishna is speaking about himself, saying he doesn't have to work. That's the difference between Krishna and us. Krishna just enjoys, right?
He plays.
Doesn't have to work. When he creates, he doesn't even have to do it. Somebody else does it for him. Right? It's all happening by his different energies. There's nothing he has to do. And I oftentimes give the example, you know, that to help us understand Krishna, that if we had nothing we had to do, and there would be no consequences, right? Usually there's so many things. We have to go to work. If I don't go to work, consequences, right? If I don't pay the bills, consequences. If I don't take care of my health, consequences. So many things we have to do. And if we don't, we're conditioned enough to know there will be consequences. But Krishna says there's nothing I have to do, and there'll never be any consequences. So that's Krishna. But what about us? Because we know there'll be consequences. And I oftentimes ask people, then if you were assured that there would be no consequences, and there was nothing you had to do, what would you do?
Follow the dream.
Follow the dream? Okay. In other words, very clear, at least my understanding, a very clear answer to that question would be, I would do what I want to do. Right? I would do it because no consequences. I would do what I want to do. There's no consequences. But we know that if we do whatever we want to do, and we don't do the things we have to do, there'll be consequences. So Krishna has nothing he has to do. He's Paramapurusha. He's the supreme enjoyer. And because there's nothing he has to do, what does he do? He does what he wants to do. But what does he want to do? And this is of course, a very important preliminary step to understanding Krishna. Because if we don't really understand Krishna, if we don't know anything about his personality, we don't know anything about what makes him the supreme, what makes him happy, when we may think if Krishna can do whatever he wants to do, and I have so many things I have to do, then why did Krishna do that to me? If he's the supreme, why can't I just be like him? Why do I have to do something? And he gets away without having to do anything. We look at that, you know, a little bit. It begins to question of like, well, who is Krishna? And why is Krishna the supreme enjoyer? I want to be like him. And of course, we look at the original, they call it, may call it the original sin. I want to enjoy, and because I'm envious that Krishna only enjoys and I can't enjoy. So I want to enjoy, and my purpose is so I how I can be happy. I want to enjoy, and in order to do that, if Krishna says something like in his concluding words of Bhagavad Gita is, if you want to enjoy, you have to surrender unto me, then it sounds very, very like, he's like an egoistic slave driver saying, you have to surrender to me if you want to enjoy it. I mean, I have to give up my ego. I have to give up my independence. I have to give up my own personal happiness. I have to sacrifice. If everything I do is meant for his pleasure. But that means we don't know Krishna. Because what gives Krishna the greatest pleasure, when Krishna does what he wants to do, what gives him the greatest pleasure is serving those who are very dear to him. And that's why he describes in these verses of the Bhagavad Gita who's dear to him. He derives great pleasure serving his devotees. That's his pleasure. Because he derives such pleasure in serving his devotees, he gives them a happiness even greater than his own happiness. Because that's what he wants to give to everybody. He wants to give him that same pleasure which he himself is experiencing. But because we've turned away from Krishna and forgotten him, consequences. Material world is a world of consequences. And they're not very good consequences. Usually the consequences are, as we explained before, repeated birth and death. Birth, death, birth, death. Accepting new bodies and attempting to find satisfaction of the self in another body, and then being incomplete at the time of death and having to go and change into another body, all being arranged by the witness of the Supreme Lord, who's in the heart, situated in the heart as the super soul. So, yes, duality means I think of myself first. Because as soon as I think of myself first, then I think of what's good for me and I avoid what's bad. What makes me happy is good. What makes me sad is bad. But we don't know the self. If we want to actually become happy, we have to know what is the self. Who am I? Jivera Surupoya Krishna Nitya Das. Self, I, by constitution, am an eternal part and parcel, servant of Krishna. I was going to give this analogy about dualities. I want to come back to that. And because again, it helps us to understand what is the world of duality and how to transcend it. So there's a series of verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam which compares duality to dreaming. And usually, at least most people can relate to dreaming. Has anybody here has never dreamed before? Huh? Everybody has, right? So we can relate to it. We know what dreams are. And there's two types of dreams. Can anyone tell me what the two types of dreams are?
Daydreams.
Huh?
Daydreams?
Well, yeah, there's a daydream. But good, huh?
Good and bad.
Good and bad. Who said that? Yes, very good. Good and bad. Good dreams. Good dream is dream that makes us happy. Bad dream, dream that makes us sad. So these verses describe that although the duality of this world doesn't exist, the conditioned soul, under the influence of his material intelligence, he's influenced by the dualities of this world. And it compares to be like a person who dreams. So when a person dreams of something desirable or to something very horrible, or he daydreams of something he would like to have or something he would like to avoid, he creates a reality that has no existence beyond his imagination. I'll explain. And then I may take some questions. A good dream. I can tell you, what do you have as anybody? I'm sure you have a certain criteria of what's a good dream. Like someone may dream they've seen a long-lost friend they haven't seen for many, many years in their dream. And they're so happy. in the dream, they're finally meeting or somebody, they've got the fulfillment of a long cherished desire in their dream, it's come to them in the dream, and they feel so happy. Right? So, during the night dream, we might dream of something very good. And then when we wake up from that good dream, how do we feel? Generally, we'll feel
disappointed.
Why?
Because
it's only a dream. But when you have a bad dream, when you have a bad dream, and whatever it may be, I also sometimes I tell my experience on this. When I use this analogy, it's because I fly so much. Sometimes I fall asleep in the plane, and in my dream, in my sleep, I imagine the plane is falling very quickly. Happens to me many times. And then I open up my eyes and I look around, and nobody else seems to be disturbed. So when you wake up from a bad dream, you feel happy. When you wake up from a good dream, you feel sad. But the happiness and the sadness that you're experiencing is not connected to reality. It's only connected to a dream. There's no connection with reality. There's no existence beyond our own imagination. So the verse speaks about, again, the night dream and the daydream. There's the night dream. And the daydream. The daydream is that we dream of something we would like to have or something we would like to avoid. During our daydream, we may be very happy thinking, yes, I'm getting closer to the fulfillment of my desires. And this anticipation of the fulfillment of our desires makes us very happy. But then we may get the fulfillment of our desires. And then those desire, the fulfillment of those desires may be put into jeopardy. And then, because we become attached to it, then we try to avoid losing that which we spent so much time trying to get. So then we're sad. So the happiness we experience from the daydreams of something we would like to have or something we would like to avoid also has no connection with reality. It's connected to our own imagination. So the verse says that although the duality of the material world doesn't ultimately exist, the conditioned soul considers it to be real under the influence of its conditioned intelligence. This imaginary experience of a world which is separate from Krishna can be compared to the acts of dreaming and desiring. So the dream is to see things separate from Krishna. That is the dream. Because nothing exists separate from Krishna. Everything is coming from Him. Everything is... every living entity has a relationship with Him. Nothing exists without Him. He says, Matak parataram nanyat kinchidasti jananjaya. There's no truth superior to me. Everything resting upon me, just like pearls are resting on a thread. Everything is resting on Him. Duality comes from forgetfulness. And as soon as we forget, then we have to live in this continuous duality. But if we remember, we can transcend duality. Just like Srila Prabhupada gives the example of the cat who carries in her mouth the kitten and the mouse. The cat comes and picks up the kitten. The kitten's not fearful. She opens up her mouth. The kitten is picked up. The kitten feels completely comforted in the mouth of the cat. Right? But when that same cat opens her mouth and shows her teeth to the mouse has a completely different perspective. This kitten, the mouse doesn't think this is my mother telling me to take me home. It's our perspective. It's the same way for one who sees Krishna everywhere. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, one who sees me everywhere, sees everything in me, then I am never lost to him, nor is he ever lost to me. Krishna consciousness means changing our consciousness. How to see everything connected to Krishna. And when we see everything connected to Krishna, we can actually develop these qualities. Be equal to friends and enemies. There's no friends and enemies because we see actually Krishna's behind everything. Not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord. There's no friends and enemies. I'm simply getting the result of my past sinful activities. And we see all, just like there's, well, anyways, that's another story. I won't go there. But he transcends duality. Doesn't see anyone as friend, doesn't see anyone as enemy. He does his equal poise in honor, dishonor, happiness and distress, heat and cold, fame and infamy. He's silent. The Prabhupada says silent means he doesn't speak about anything that's non-essential. He speaks about only that which is conducive for his progressive development in Krishna consciousness. He's fixed in knowledge and engaged in my devotional service. Krishna says he's very dear to me. So the reason why Krishna gives all these different descriptions is to help us to understand how to become dear to Krishna and how to feel fully protected by Krishna. We may not be able to be on that platform, as you've already said, that yes, we can't immediately come to that platform artificially. It's not simply a mental adjustment. But Krishna says, yeyatamam prapajate tangsadaiva bhajamyaham. To the degree that you surrender unto me, I reciprocate accordingly. You take one step to Krishna, Krishna takes 100 steps to you. The more you actually approach Krishna, Krishna reveals more and more of himself to the living being. This is Krishna consciousness. This is the foundation of devotional service, and this is a little bit about this verse. I didn't get into all the details. Does anybody have any questions about anything we talked about?
I have a question, but it may be tough. Maybe take it in private.
It may be tough?
Yes. Can we take it in private?
I can, if you like, afterwards. Okay. Does anybody have a public question?
No, I think the battery is dying.
Battery is dying?
What would be recommendation? We understand, with our mind, I understand that there is a duality, there are some good people and bad people, and sometimes those sort of enemy of yours are pushing your buttons. And how to try to see Krishna in those people who are evil? What would your recommendation?
Huh?
That's a very good example of duality.
Duality, yes. How to see Krishna in people who are evil?
Yeah, and who are trying to push your buttons.
Trying to push it.
Intentionally.
Well, we should, as I alluded to before, that we should see Krishna's hand in everything.
Right.
And there's a reason for everything that's happening to us. It's not so easy. Right? I oftentimes quote a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Tiraskrita Vipalabdha Kshaptakshipta Hatahapi, that devotees of the Lord are so forbearing that even if they are cheated, they're cursed, neglected, insulted, disturbed, or even killed, they're never inclined to avenge themselves. That's the characteristic of a devotee. But why? How can somebody be in that state of consciousness? It's not so easy to see somebody. Well, our tendency is to think that somebody's trying to push my button. He's my enemy.
Yes. Yeah.
And my enemy, I want to get back. But Krishna says, Matra spasha stukontiya sitoshna sukha dukha daha. The non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of the winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception and one has to tolerate them without being disturbed. Whatever distress that we may experience, apparently by the hands of an enemy, is temporary. We have to learn to tolerate it. And we have to see it as that whatever I'm getting is simply the result of my own past activities. It's hard to own up to that. It's very hard to own up to that. Right? But that's how to, at least how to adjust our way of thinking. But as we said, it's not very easy to immediately just come to that platform. Mm-hmm. So, but we should try to avoid vengeance, because that doesn't do any good
for us. No, I'm not talking about vengeance. I'm just trying to understand
how to see it as Krishna.
Yeah, how to see it as, and you explained it.
Yes, it's how to say it as Krishna is Krishna is very kind, that I should have suffered much more.
But good mantra.
But something happens.
And he's minimized it in this way. To help me remember him. Because any suffering that we experience, actually, should be an impetus to remember him.
Okay.
Let me remember him. And the more we remember him, the more, just like the kitten, who remembers my mother's protecting me. She's not going to hurt me. The more we remember Krishna, we see Krishna everything, we transcend duality, and we see Krishna behind it, and we feel sheltered. Because Krishna is all good. Krishna is not like a vindictive master who wants to punish us and to make us suffer. We're suffering due to our own past activities. Krishna wants us to be happy, and he comes to tell him, to reveal himself, to leave his pastimes, to deliver his names. He makes so much effort. He accompanies us in the heart as the super soul to bear witness, waiting for us to turn to him. And as soon as we turn to him, he's ready to instruct us and guide us and to help us to come to. He's not forgotten us. We've forgotten him.
Yeah.
We've forgotten. He's not forgotten us. Not forgotten anyone. He's there. But we have a tendency to think, oh, I'm independent. Although he's in the heart, he knows everything that we desire. Just like a person who's next to a flower can immediately understand the fragrance of the flower by being next to it, Krishna, who's in the heart, immediately understands our desires. He knows everything. So we should learn how to see Krishna in everything. And when we do, we'll feel comforted. That Krishna knows what's best for me because he wants me to come to him. And whatever reactions or suffering I'm experiencing in this world, it's to help me to remember him. Just like if we put our hand in fire, it's painful, but it's good too. Why? Because if you didn't feel the pain, you'd lose your hand. But because you feel the pain, you take your hand out of the fire. Same thing as this material world is suffering. So someone would say, why so much suffering? But it's good, because we don't belong here. We don't belong here. This is not our permanent place of residence. So an intelligent person will know, why should I try to counteract my suffering by engaging in another activity which is going to produce more suffering? And that's what people do. They try to counteract their suffering by engaging in another activity which is going to produce more suffering. And that's why Krishna goes on to explain to Arjuna how to become free from the reactions of work. Why don't I do that which is going to put a permanent end to all of this suffering? So if we see that ultimately Krishna is behind it, then we can accept the suffering. Because it's ultimately going to bring me closer to Krishna. It may not be easy. We have to tolerate. Krishna says, I'll help. Whatever you're lacking, I'll give you. Whatever you have, I'll preserve for you. He's always there to help. So how to see when somebody's doing that? We should see, Krishna sent him to do this to me. I oftentimes tell a story. You want to ask a question? This is a public question. Okay.
Somebody mentioned that it is very hard to attain Satvaguna. I wonder why, and what is the way?
Well, Satvaguna is one who's illuminate in knowledge. But because he's illumined in knowledge, and he studies scripture, his habits are all clean. Many other symptoms of Satvaguna. But what you ask, why is it so difficult?
Why would people think it's so difficult? And what is the way to improve to move there?
To move there? Well, there's certain activities which are conducive for the development of Satvaguna.
So it's real practical, there is a practical way.
Yes, that's definitely.
Tell us a bit more.
A practical way to come to the platform of Satvaguna?
And what is Satvaguna?
Satvaguna is the mode of goodness. Satvaguna is where, we do not want to cause harm to anybody. We engage in activities which are for the welfare of others. We think of the welfare of others instead of thinking of ourselves.
But then we deprive them of suffering and the way to Krishna.
Excuse me?
But then we deprive them of suffering and the way to Krishna.
Yes, that's true, but that's Satvaguna. That's not Shuddhasattva. Shuddhasattva is pure goodness. Pure sattva is a very difficult stage to get to. This is a difficult stage to get to. But Satvaguna, there are certain activities of Satvaguna which are conducive for helping others and for helping ourselves. But sattva, and Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, the modes of material nature are always vying for superiority. Sometimes we're under the influence of sattva. Sometimes we're under the influence of tamas. Sometimes we're under the influence of rajas. Right. What, sooner we come to the platform of pure sattva, that's shuddha sattva. So on the platform of shuddha sattva, obviously, we give them, help them to see Krishna in everything. But for those who are on the platform of sattva, they perform pious activities, perform philanthropic works, they're not selfish, they're clean in their habits, they're learned, they have knowledge of scripture. Those are the symptoms of Satvaguna. But it's not pure sattva. Right? Because still they're influenced by tamas and rajas. There's no pure tamas, pure rajas, pure sattva. They're always competing with each other. And we're being influenced by the three modes of material nature who are always pulling us in different ways. But we can move towards sattva.
Intention.
Yes, willfully move towards sattva by study of the scripture, practice of restraint. Restrain the sattva. Whereas platform of shuddha sattva is, rather than simply restraint, devotee comes to the platform of the transcendental platform of shuddha sattva by engaging in service to Krishna. And then, is it the embodied soul may restrict himself from sense enjoyment, although the taste still remains, but ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he becomes fixed in consciousness. Right, this is platforms of devotional service. One gets the higher pleasure of devotional service, and automatically he transcends. But it's not complete. There's incomplete transcendence, partial transcendence, and then there's complete transcendence. And that takes time and a lot of purification.
Question. You said not to harm anybody, but if it's a sport?
If it's a sport?
Yeah.
If it's a sport means... Like boxing, is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying, if you're doing that thing for yourself and for the competition, I don't know, it's like that.
Yeah, there'll be consequences.
Of course.
There's always consequences in the modes of material nature.
So, and during this point, do you do it intentionally or just accidentally? If you hurt somebody accidentally, it's a different
story. No, intentionally.
Oh. Intentionally.
Yeah, like let's say the box. Yeah, it's like does that like a.
What's the question?
No, I mean it's like you're not supposed to harm somebody, but if it's in a sport, is it that thing allowed
or
not?
Is it considered to be a harm?
Of course.
I think as long as the emotions of anger are not involved, then you're not harming anyone. But as long as you lose it to your emotions of anger and revenge, then you lost it. Then you're harming someone.
But why
despite
would you?
The fact that it's, despite the fact that it's sport.
Oh,
this is like excuse. Oh, that's the sport, that is why I can
help
someone.
You use
it like excuse.
No, I'm just saying, like, the man itself, he need to, like, just do some activity anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, so
but
build a house.
House, no. That's work. That's work. That's not, like, activity.
So you're talking about sports.
I'm sorry?
You're talking about sports, not necessarily boxing.
Not necessarily the boxing, yeah, but any like a sport, what's like a you by the rules you have to like a just
cause pain to somebody else.
Not cause pain, but just a win. But the winning comes from the pain. Yeah, of course.
We should not willfully cause pain to any living being. There'll be consequences, even in sports.
I guess the question, are you responsible for the
task? Yes, you
are. Pick
a different sport. Yeah.
If you want to.
But this is your choice.
I won't say that. Just say if you want to fight, then you have to be like Arjuna. Krishna, Arjuna had to fight, but he was fighting on behalf of Krishna. Trying to think of what the Vedic sports are, like wrestling, considered to be like a Vedic sport. Yeah. Huh?
Krishna wrestling with his, friends.
His friends. Yeah, but that's, that's a sport, a wrestling. But it's not to cause harm, it's to give Krishna pleasure. That's what distinguishes frivolous sports from, is what gives Krishna pleasure.
Reconcile, so this
reconcile.
And then who's going to be protecting the land?
The land?
If the enemy invades the land,
yes.
And we're not supposed, they are not supposed, men are not supposed to harm anyone and do sports, so who's going to protect the land? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so we're all supposed to give in to the karma of a nation and die.
Oh, I'm sorry, I got lost on that.
So the logic is behind that is, so if men are not supposed to do the sport, so they're not able to protect the land, so if enemy invades the land, so what are we supposed to do, all of us? Okay. Just wait for the enemy to enter the house and kill all of us?
Well, it depends what one's duty is. That's what the whole essence
so
of Bhagavad.
Yeah.
There are duties defined by one's nature.
Oh, this, where is it prescribed?
Krishna's the whole Bhagavad Gita is.
You have this
perform chaturvanya maya shristam guna kama vibhagasa. There are four orders of life, which is prescribed according to one's particular nature. Some people have a nature of kshatriya, which means to protect from hurt.
Those people can do
sports. Yes.
Oh, so it's like the worker.
Because they're actually doing that in order to prepare themselves for their work, their duty.
Oh, so that's why I understand.
Yes, for their duty.
Yeah, I got it, yeah. Okay, so if we would translate instead of sport, we translate to the duty, it's fine.
If it's according to one's duty, yes.
If it's your karma.
Krishna told Arjuna to kill, basically,
yeah,
not just harm.
Did, yeah.
Yeah. And how could Krishna kill if he wasn't angry? He had to be angry, but he had to use his anger for Krishna's service. That's a kshatriya supposed to be angry. You can't just... You have to be angry to fight. But it's in Krishna's service to protect religious principles.
It's a trick to it, because I was reading about the best warriors, and the best warriors were samurais and Kazakhs. Why? Because they didn't have this anger, and they went whenever they were going into a fight. I was kshatriya before, I've checked, so it interests me. So they were actually somehow managing their emotions. They were dead by the time of that fight, so that's why they are like... Since they were not able to actually lose the battle to their emotions, because they were actually winning most of the
Yeah, they were not controlled by their emotions.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
they used their emotions to fulfill a higher purpose.
Yeah, they used, but they were like, I'm just interested, like how, what's the methodology of doing that? How can you control your emotions?
It's not easy. how to control your emotions and not be controlled by your emotions.
Yes. Because the moment you're controlled by your emotion, you lose the battle. At that moment.
Right. Yeah. It's just like, there's a story in the Srimad Bhagavatam Prabhupada tells about a snake who became a disciple of Narada Muni. Oh. And when the snake became the disciple of Narada Muni instructed the snake, you become a devotee, you should not seek vengeance, you should not cause anyone harm, you should not bite anybody, you have to be a good devotee. So then the snake became a very good disciple, a very good devotee, but then the children found out that the snake wasn't biting anybody, and the children started to beat the snake. But he was instructed not to cause harm to anybody. So he came back to Narada Muni and said, what should I do? I'm instructed not to cause any harm, not to become angry. I'm tolerating it, but it's very hard to just... I'm a snake. There are these children always beating me. What should I do? So Narada Muni said, well, you should raise your hoods as if you're about to bite, but don't bite. So... So you have to control your emotions, control your anger, but not be controlled by your anger. Because if he was controlled by his anger, he'd bite.
Yeah.
And you lose.
Yeah.
You disobey the order of Narada Muni.
So coming back to the question of duality, are we supposed to actually raise our hood to other people, like...
Should we raise our hood?
Yes. When dealing with other people attacking us. The question was about
enemies.
Yes, the question was about that, yeah.
How to behave.
Behave.
Of course we're going to forgive them. Of course we're going to understand it's the game. Of course we're going to understand it's the plan. But we have emotions, we're in human bodies. So should we raise the hood to let the person know it's his or her place?
To put them in their place?
Yes. Without killing, yeah.
Well, certainly in the material world, when you're dealing with materialistic people who are very exploitative by nature, many of them are very envious, certainly we can raise our hoods.
So that's the duality you need to talk about.
Yes.
Like not to bite, not to kill, yeah. but not to get angry, but appropriately.
Put them in their place.
Yes.
The idea when you offer food to Krishna, and Krishna will accept it, but if, let's say, you offer something really bad, what Krishna will do? Krishna just don't accept it. So if someone offers you something really bad, you just don't accept it.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
You,
yeah.
You cannot tell people not to offer you.
Yeah,
what
exactly.
You can do, you can just not accept it.
Oh, that's nice.
Something else? You look like you have something. Gears are turning.
No. I'm tolerant, like a diary.
working, what's going on right now.
Life-changing decisions.
No, it's not like, no, the decision is already made. I'm just trying to make it work out right now.
All right. What time is it? 8 o'clock?